Coming up on Harvard Chan This Week in Health, the benefits of green space.
At higher levels of vegetation were associated with lower levels of mortality.
The new study linking green surroundings to improved health in women. Plus, what does it mean to be happy? Why the answer to that question could impact our health. And another reason to limit your consumption of fast food, the new concerns that go beyond high levels of saturated fat and salt. Hello and welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Noah Levitt, and it's Friday, April 22nd.
And I'm Amy Montemuro. And Noah, today is Earth Day. And in that spirit, we're going to begin with a story that highlights the benefits of green space.
That's right, Amy. New research from the Harvard Chan School found that women who live in areas surrounded by more vegetation, things like trees, bushes, or even grass, had a lower mortality rate than women in less green areas. So with mortality rate researchers, we're looking at the number of deaths in a particular group over a specific period of time. And in this case, that group was 108,000 women involved in the Nurses' Health Study. And the women in areas with the most greenery had a 12% lower mortality rate.
Now, to calculate this, the study's authors compared rates of mortality from the study with satellite imagery that showed levels of vegetation surrounding the homes of study participants. So why did women in the greenest areas have lower mortality rates? Well, according to the study, a big key is improved mental health, measured through lower levels of depression. Other factors were increased opportunity for social engagement, higher physical activity, and lower exposure to air pollution. Researchers also saw lower levels of respiratory disease and cancer in the greenest areas.
In order to isolate the effect of vegetation, researchers did take into account other risk factors, such as age, socioeconomic status, race and ethnicity, and smoking behaviors. We spoke about the study with one of the authors, Peter James, a research associate in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School. And he says that this research doesn't necessarily mean that rural areas are better than urban ones. The study simply looked at the impact of vegetation in any form.
This measure is truly just a measure of quantity of vegetation. So if it's a tree, if it's grass, if it's a park, it really doesn't make any judgments on the quality. So it could be a vacant lot that's overgrown, or it could be a beautifully manicured park. It may be the same exact value on this vegetation index. We're really just getting at the absolute quantity of vegetation around your home, as opposed to thinking about more subjective measures such as, this is a nice park or this is an open space. This is really just looking at vegetation and trying to, tease out, is there a relationship between vegetation and mortality, not parks, not other kind of constructs that we may think of.
James adds that planting vegetation can also mitigate the effects of climate change. So this research shows that such steps can have an important co-benefit.
And if you want to see some examples of the satellite imagery showing different levels of vegetation, just head to our website, hsph.me/thisweekinhealth. The world is taking a massive step this week towards finally eradicating polio.
In a large coordinated effort, 155 countries and territories are switching to an updated oral polio vaccine. According to the New York Times, it's the first time the world has ever attempted this type of vaccine change. And health officials are incredibly close to eradicating polio. In 2015, there were just 74 cases, all in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This year, there have been just 9 cases, also in those countries.
And the main reason for the switch is that this new vaccine will protect against 2 polio strains, type 1 and type 3. The old vaccine also protected against type 2 polio, but that was eradicated in 1999. Because this essentially useless component has been removed, the new vaccine is considered stronger, and it's also considered safer. Last year, there were 32 cases of paralysis linked to the oral polio vaccine, which contains some of the live virus, and more than 90% were linked to the type 2 component. It's important to note that the U.S. uses an injectable polio vaccine, which does not contain the live virus.
A top U.S. official says that the country will likely see some local outbreaks of the Zika virus in the coming months. The country has seen about 350 cases of Zika where people have been infected while traveling abroad. But in a series of TV interviews, Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says that will likely change, and we will start seeing some cases transmitted in the U.S. Even then, Fauci says this won't be a widespread outbreak, predicting, quote, dozens of cases at most. Fauci says the U.S. is prepared, but is urging Congress to approve nearly $2 billion in emergency funding to fight Zika, which which would include developing a vaccine.
Doctors may have a new tool in the fight against breast cancer, which kills more than 500,000 women worldwide each year.
It's the result of a collaboration between scientists at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. They identified a molecular marker in healthy breast tissue that can predict a woman's risk for developing breast cancer up to 6 years in advance. The marker is called Ki-67, and researchers say that women with higher percentages of it are 5 times more likely to develop breast cancer.
Doctors already test breast tumors for Ki-67 because it can help inform decisions about treatment. But these findings could allow doctors to use this marker as a key predictive tool. We spoke about the study with one of the authors, Rula Tamimi, who is an associate professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School.
There are a number of women who end up getting biopsies just through mammographic screening. So when you get a mammogram, there may be something that is suspicious on the mammogram, and that leads to a biopsy. And the majority of women who get a biopsy after a mammogram are benign. So there is no cancer. So this might be like a nice sort of serendipitous opportunity to use this marker to see, okay, is this woman at a, you know, a higher than average risk of breast cancer? And if so, you know, that may suggest that maybe she should either think about additional screening modalities or preventive strategies. But right now we sort of apply the same sort of screening to every woman that comes in the door. So this might help us to better sort of personalize either screening or risk prevention.
While the results of the study are encouraging, Tamimi says more research is needed before doctors can begin screening for Ki-67.
Since October 2010, Haiti has endured a massive cholera epidemic that has killed more than 9,000 people and sickened hundreds of thousands.
But it could have been stopped with a simple health kit for less than $2,000. That's according to a team of Yale researchers who've been investigating the cholera epidemic, which began shortly after a massive earthquake devastated Haiti.
The source of the outbreak has been identified as UN peacekeepers who were transferred to Haiti from Nepal. The researchers say that administering a basic screening test to those peacekeepers, coupled with antibiotics and vaccinations, could have reduced the probability of an outbreak by 98%. The total cost, just about $3.50 per peacekeeper. It will cost an estimated $2 billion to end the current outbreak.
And as a result of this study, the authors are urging the UN to adopt screening and preventative antibiotics as a routine treatment when relocating peacekeepers. We know why fast food isn't healthy. It's made with processed ingredients, high saturated fat, and it's full of sodium.
But now new research reveals another potential concern: exposure to hormone-disrupting chemicals known as phthalates. Those chemicals are commonly used in products like soap or makeup and have been linked to a number of health problems, including infertility and an increased risk of various allergies in children.
Researchers at George Washington University looked at data from nearly 9,000 people collected over a 7-year period. The data included detailed information about what each person had eaten over a 24-hour period and urine samples. The scientists found that people who said they had eaten fast food in the last 24 hours had much higher levels of two phthalates, DEHP and DINP, than those who reported eating no fast food. The increase in these phthalates ranged from 15 to 39%, depending on how much fast food someone ate.
And what's interesting here is that the increased levels may be more tied to the manufacturing process than the food itself. That's because products are likely to touch machines, plastic, or conveyor belts, which may have higher levels of phthalates, allowing the chemicals to leach into foods. DEHP, one of those phthalates Amy mentioned, has been banned from all children's toys in the United States and Europe, and DINP has also been banned from toys that children put in their mouth.
Finally in this episode, Noah, what is happiness? And how can happiness affect our health?
Pretty big questions, and those are questions that a new research center at the Harvard Chan School will be attempting to answer. Researchers at the newly established Lee Kum-Shung Center for Health and Happiness will work to understand the complex relationship between positive psychological well-being and things such as cardiovascular health or healthy aging.
A growing body of research does suggest that positive emotions promote good health, while negative emotions, such as stress, can lead to poor health outcomes. But it's still unclear how exactly our emotional well-being can translate into physical health. And the critical question at the center of this is, what does it really mean to be happy?
Just because someone isn't depressed doesn't necessarily mean that they are in a very good space. So the way we've talked about it is to say that the absence of bad is not necessarily the same as the presence of having something good. So we've been really interested in understanding, what is health? What is positive health beyond just the absence of disease?
That's Laura Kubzanski, a co-director of the New Center and a professor of social and behavioral science at the Harvard Chan School.
She's conducted research showing that our emotions play an important role in the development of a number of conditions, including cardiovascular disease, lung function decline, and cancer. In 2007, a study led by Kubzanski showed that emotional vitality, which could be described as a sense of enthusiasm, of hopefulness, of engagement in life, or the ability to face stress with emotional balance, all of that appears to reduce a person's risk of coronary heart disease.
Kubzanski says understanding connections like this are critical because it allows for a more proactive approach to health rather than a reactive one.
Public health talks a lot about risk factors and trying to identify risk factors and to maybe mitigate risk factors once they occur. And one of the arguments we've been making is that we really need to prevent the risk of risks. Preventing risks from occurring is to figure out what are the strengths that people need in order to not end up with a risk factor, or what are the assets that will facilitate ways to help people be more adaptive so that you're not trying to fix a problem after it's already established, but you are preventing the problems from occurring.
One of the ways the center will try to achieve that goal is by creating a well-being or happiness index.
And that index could then be used to identify people who are highly satisfied with their lives or people who might be more distressed, and in turn develop targeted interventions to help those individuals be happier and healthier.
If you're interested in reading more about the center and Kubzanski's work, visit our website, hsph.me/thisweekinhealth.
And that is all for this edition of Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Montemiro. You can always find this podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, or Stitcher.